Last week, we talked a little bit about some of the lessons that God was teaching the children of Israel in the early days. We talked about, actually, let me bring them up here. Right from the very beginning, when Isaac was born, he was persecuted by his older brother, Ishmael. And we looked at some examples where Isaac was persecuted as an adult, where Jacob was persecuted as an adult. And then, of course, Jacob's 12 sons, who became the 12 tribes of Israel, went down into Egypt, and there they ended up, their descendants ended up becoming slaves to the Egyptians. And all of that, from the birth of Isaac until God brought the children of Israel out of Egypt, during that time of their persecution, was how many years? What'd you say, Isaac?
I don't know. 400 from when Isaac was first persecuted until when they brought out 400 years.
Yes, 400 years from the birth of Isaac until the God had Moses bring the Israelites out. So they got a good taste of how it feels to be on the receiving end of injustice, right? For that 400 year period. Some of the other lessons that Jacob learned, and I'm going to be referring to the nation of Israel by the name Jacob, because that was Isaac's son's name, and then God changed his name to Israel, and so the children of Israel are the children of Jacob, right? Same man. But God refers to him, even after his death, when he's talking about his descendants as a whole, as a group, he refers to them as Jacob, his firstborn son. Even when Moses went to appear before Pharaoh, right? He said, "Let my son go, my firstborn son." All right, so another thing that they learned during this period of time, from Isaac's birth until the children of Israel came out of Egypt, was who this God was, this God of Abraham, who appeared to their father, Abraham, and then to Isaac, and then to Jacob. What are some of the ways that God made himself known to the children of Israel during this time?
What time?
Well, all the way up until the time when God brought them out of Egypt through Moses. What's that?
The plagues.
Okay, the plagues. That's a good one. The plagues that God brought down on Egypt certainly showed God's power and his determination and it showed his power over probably the most powerful man on earth at the time, is from their perspective, was Pharaoh, right? And God sort of made a quick dispatch Pharaoh pretty quickly and easily in a pretty amazing demonstration of the plagues. What else?
Parting of the Red Sea.
That's another one. Did you have something else?
Okay,
the pillar of fire and the pillar of cloud. Those are pretty amazing demonstrations, right, Kathy?
Provision of food and water.
Okay, yes. He provided them with food and water while they were in the wilderness. Now, of course, that came after the Exodus, but that's all right. We're still... anything else? All right, okay. Yes,
sorry.
Go ahead.
I was going to say you could say the fulfillment of the other end of when God told Abraham that his people would go through injustice for 400 years. He said, later I'm going to bring you out with great possession.
Yes, he did.
Which
he did. Right. So, yes, that's another. Actually, that kind of demonstrates his faithfulness to keep his word. After 400 years, he did exactly what he said he was going to do. And he did it exactly when he said he was going to do it. That's another important point. All right. Now, justice. One of the lessons that, remember, we're talking about these things from the perspective of what lessons was God teaching to his people, the nation of Israel, throughout these events. What was he trying to teach them? And we looked at some of the lessons that God had taught them last time, right? And he gave them his law, which was sort of, God laying out a description of what real justice should look like, right? Isn't that what the law of Moses was? Now, some people have the idea the law of Moses is a universal law for everybody to keep, and that's not the case. God gave that law to a particular nation, the nation of Israel, to govern that nation in that particular circumstance. All right, so it was sort of like their national legal system at the time. But at the same time, if you look at all those laws, you get a sense of what justice is. As you apply those laws in all the various situations that they were to apply them, you get a sense of what kind of justice God had in mind, right? And the justice in the law is a reflection of God's character, his own nature. Isn't that right? All right, so let's look at these experiences just briefly. All right, God brought Jacob out of Egypt by his mighty acts, which shows his power, right? God judged their oppressors with justice. Now, you know, when we talk about the law showing God's justice, something else showed God's justice even before he gave them the law, and that was the way that he judged Pharaoh and the way he judged the Egyptians. Because remember, God had allowed the Egyptians and others to persecute his people for a 400-year period, and that they were learning by being on the receiving end of injustice, right? He allowed them to persecute them and treat them as slaves and so forth. They were on the receiving end of injustice. But when God brought all that to an end, and he did it in such a miraculous and an amazing way, he brought justice upon Egypt and upon Pharaoh, right? With the plagues, with killing the firstborn sons. He brought his justice upon them. Now, there's some lessons from that. Sometimes justice takes a long time. Isn't that right? Sometimes you have to put up with injustice for a long time, but in the end, God is going to bring justice. So the Israelites saw that God brought justice finally to their oppressors, and then God gives them his code book, sort of law, so that they could understand the quality of God's justice as well. All right? And then they were to follow that. Now, we already talked about that one. We talked about God feeding them with manna. What kind of qualities would the Israelites learn about God based on the fact that he fed them with manna in the wilderness? What are they going to learn about God's nature? I mean, they've learned about his power, right? They've learned about his justice. What?
Mercy.
Faithfulness and mercy, right? I mean, he told them, look, he sent them Moses, and he said, I'm going to bring you out of Egypt, and I'm going to bring you into this land flowing with milk and honey, and I'm going to help you defeat your enemies over in that land, and I'm going to give you all that land and all that. But they've got this big desert to go through between leaving Egypt and arriving at the promised land. There's a desert. It's a pretty big desert. And there's no food, and there's no water. What did he do? He gave them food, he gave them water every single day. Now, every day, they went outside in the morning and collected the manna that had come from God and was laying on the ground. Every day they did that. And you know what else they did? Does anybody know how long it took to get out when they left Egypt until they got to the entrance to the promised land? How long did that take? I heard a mumble, I didn't hear. What? It was almost 2 years, I believe.
It's a short journey.
Yes, but they're carrying a lot of people, all right? And then, of course, they disobeyed, and then God made them wander in the wilderness for 40 years later. But and you know what he did? Even after they disobeyed, and he told them they were going to have to wander in the wilderness for a 40-year period as punishment, you know what he did? He continued to provide manna every day for the entire 40 years. The Bible says that the manna stopped after they crossed over the Jordan and went into the promised land under Joshua 40 years later. That's when the manna stopped appearing. And he gave them water out of the rock and all that kind of stuff. So even in God's judgment and his punishment, he still provides. Isn't that amazing? I thought that's a pretty important lesson that they should have learned. He brought them to the entrance of the promised land. Again, they're seeing that this God is faithful, that he will keep his word. All right? Now, here's the problem. Throughout that time when God brought the children of Israel out of Egypt, and to about a two-year period until he got them where they were ready to go into the promised land. They did many things in rebellion against God. What was the first thing that they did in rebellion against God? The golden calf, that's right. Right while they were there at Mount Sinai, Moses is up on the mountain getting God's law, and Aaron builds a golden calf, and they, you know, start doing all that stuff. Well, in between that time and the time when they sent the spies into the land, we'll read in Numbers. We're going to go there in a minute. But they had provoked God to anger 10 times. 10 times. It's amazing. In fact, there, can you think of any of the other instances where they provoked God to anger? Yes.
They were waiting for water. They were complaining that they weren't going to.
Okay.
Constant
complaining. Constant complaining. Right. What else?
I was going to say complaining about
eating the manna every day. They complained about not having water. Then they complained about they were tired of the manna. They wanted meat. They wanted some quail. So God sent them quails. Right. What else? Remember when they were at the foot of Mount Sinai after God gave the law, he was given all the instructions about building the tabernacle and all that kind of stuff. Because during that two-year period, they were building the tabernacle and that sort of thing too, right? And then Moses anointed his brother Aaron to be the high priest. And then his two sons, Nadab and Abihu, were supposed to be priests under Aaron as the high priest. And he gave very clear instructions on how they were to carry out their duties in the tabernacle of God. And they got very sloppy about it. They didn't care. They said, you know, God said, I want you to bring fire from the altar and bring it in the censer. You must take the fire from here and do it this way. Well, they went and they just got any old fire, you know, started a fire or whatever, and brought it into the house of God. And you know what happened? Does anybody know what happened to them? It said fire came out from the presence of God and consumed them. That is, it burnt them to a crisp right in front of Aaron, their father. Just two men, poof, there they go, crispy critters. And God's, you know, and Aaron's like, he was upset about it, but Moses reminded him about what God said. And you know what? This is the God we're dealing with here. You don't mess with this God, okay? Yes, he can provide every day. He's promised you these incredible things that he's going to do, and he's given you his law, and you don't take it lightly. That was the lesson from that, wasn't it? You don't take it lightly when you're dealing with the holy things of God. You don't take it lightly. There was actually many examples of that in the Old Testament as well. But anyway, they provoked God to anger. Remember the serpents? He sent serpents among them as well. He judged them. You know, what these things were, from the time he brought them out of Egypt, he showed them all his great power, and then they rebelled against him and rebelled against him, and he judged them. These were little tests. These were little exams of whether they were learning, whether Jacob was learning the lessons that his father, God, was trying to teach him. You understand what I'm saying? And he judged them and judged them and judged them. And now we get to the instance that I want to talk about today. Go to Numbers chapter 12. This is the, I just briefly want to mention this one. In Numbers 12, this is Miriam and Aaron rebelled against God and against Moses. Miriam was Moses' sister, and Aaron was Moses' brother. And here's Moses. He's the youngest. And God chose the youngest of the three children to lead his people Israel. And Miriam and Aaron, you know, they're going along and they're seeing God, you know, doing all these miraculous things and all this kind of stuff. But Moses is the guy in charge, and he's their kid brother. And there's this jealousy thing going on. There's a jealousy thing. And so then Moses really ticks them off. Because if you look in verse chapter 12 of Numbers, verse 1, then Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Ethiopian woman whom he had married. for he had married an Ethiopian woman. Well, what's the big deal about that? Well, Moses is white and she's black. That's the problem. I mean, they thought it was a problem. Moses didn't think it was a problem. And God didn't think it was a problem. But they got jealous of Moses, and so they used this as an opportunity to undermine Moses and his authority because of certain prejudices that people had in those days. So they said, verse 2, "Has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us also?" In other words, look, you know, yeah, God chose Moses to lead, but why not us too, see? And they're using that, what Moses did, as some kind of a way to get the people on their side and to, you know, against Moses. And it was a wicked thing, and God was very angry. So they said, verse 3. "Now the man Moses was very humble, more than all the men who were on the face of the earth. Suddenly the Lord said to Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, 'Come out, you three, to the tabernacle of meeting.' So the three came out. Then the Lord came down in the pillar of cloud and stood in the door of the tabernacle and called Aaron and Miriam. And they both went forward. And he said, 'Hear now my words. If there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, make myself known to him in a vision. I speak to him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my house. I speak with him face to face, even plainly and not in dark sayings. And he sees the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses?' So the anger of the Lord was aroused against them, and he departed. And when the cloud departed from above the tabernacle, suddenly Miriam became leprous, as white as snow." Don't you think there's a little bit of comic relief there? Don't you see something kind of funny there? You know, people who have leprosy. In fact, if you look at the law, when God delivered the law of Moses, it had specific regulations about how the priests were to check to see if people had leprosy. And what it was is the leprosy would begin by the skin turning white. I mean, snow white. No coloring at all in spots. And they had ways of testing the skin to see if it was leprous, because leprosy was contagious. And they had to separate the people if they began getting these white spots on their skin. And all this is in the law of Moses. And so Miriam, Moses' sister, apparently she was the instigator of this, he covered her with leprosy from head to foot, so she was as white as snow from head to foot. She's complaining because Moses married a black woman, and so God turned her white and made her a leper. Did you see any comedy in that? It's kind of funny, actually. But anyway, what happens? So Aaron said to Moses, verse 11, "Oh, my Lord, please do not lay this sin on us, in which we have done foolishly and in which we have sinned. Please do not let her be as one dead whose flesh is half consumed when he comes out of his mother's womb." So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, "Please heal her, O God, I pray." Then the Lord said to Moses, "If her father had but spit in her face, would she not be shunned 7 days? Let her be shut out of the camp 7 days, and afterward she may be received again." So Miriam was shut out of the camp 7 days, and the people did not journey until Miriam was brought back in again. And of course they had to check her to make sure that there was no leprosy and all that. All those instructions are in the law of Moses. God showed himself to be merciful in this particular case, right? But I've told you guys before that there are times when God puts up with our stupidity and our foolishness and our rebellion for a while, and then he says that's enough. Isn't that right? We have plenty of examples of that in the scripture. Now we come to a time when God says that's enough. Let's read in Numbers chapter 13 now. Here's what I want you to see. After the children of Israel had learned all these lessons, God showing himself and providing for them, showing himself powerful and faithful and caring and punishing them at times, we come to the big exam now. it's time for Israel to take sort of like a final exam where it's pass or fail. And this is the 10th time that they provoke God, and this was the exam. So what is the exam? Well, first of all, he said he wanted them to go into the promised land like he told them. He was bringing them to the promised land, right? He wanted them to go in and defeat the Canaanites. And he had promised that he would go with them and fight their battles for them, and that by his power, they would defeat the Canaanites. So they were to rely on God's power. Isn't that right? They were to rely on God's faithfulness to keep his word. And they were to rely on God's motives. That is, don't question his motives. Should the children of Israel by this time had understood God's pure motives? What was God's pure motive at this point? Why was he doing all this with the nation of Israel?
To show his justice.
To show his what?
Justice.
Yes, that's all part of it. But why was he bothering to do all that with this group of people? Yes. Yes, but why? Why them, and why not, you know, some other group of people somewhere else?
Ultimately, because of Abraham's faithfulness.
Because of the promises that he made to Abraham, their forefather. He made a covenant with Abraham of what he was going to do with Abraham's descendants, right? Bless them, make of them a great nation, and all the promises that he made. Give them the land as an eternal inheritance, all the stuff he promised them. Here's God doing, time after time, if you read through these early books of the Bible, you'll see that God kept telling the Israelites, I'm not doing this because you're so special. I'm not doing this because you're better than anybody else. I'm doing this because of the promises I made to your father Abraham. That's what he said. See? God made those covenants and promises. Now, if God is, after 400 years, God brings him out of Egypt, because he told Abraham he would. That's pretty faithful, don't you think? It's pretty faithful. They should have believed him. They should have. They saw his power. They should have trusted that he would defeat the enemies. They should have trusted his faithfulness. They should have trusted his motives. But they questioned and challenged all of those things. Let's read the story now. Chapter 13 of Numbers. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, send men to spy out the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the children of Israel. From each tribe of their fathers you shall send a man, every one a leader among them. So Moses sent them from the wilderness of Paran, according to the commandment of the Lord, all of them, men who were heads of the children of Israel. Now these were the names from the tribe of Reuben, Shammua, the son of Zachar. From the tribe of Simeon, Shaphat, the son of Hori. From the tribe of Judah, Caleb, the son of Jephunneh. From the tribe of Issachar, Igal, the son of Joseph. From the tribe of Ephraim, Hoshea, the son of Nun. And this is the guy who, his name was changed to Joshua a little later, as we'll see. From the tribe of Benjamin, Palti, the son of Rephu. From the tribe of Zebulun, Gadiel, the son of Sodi. From the tribe of Joseph, that is from the tribe of Manasseh, Gadi, the son of Susi. From the tribe of Dan, Amiel, the son of Gamali. From the tribe of Asher, Sether, the son of Michael. From the tribe of Naphtali, Navi, the son of Voshiat. I hate all these names. I have trouble pronouncing. From the tribe of Gad, Guel, the son of Machi. These are the names of the men who Moses sent to spy out the land. So you got 12 heads of 12 tribes. Two of those are Joshua and Caleb. Verse 16, these are the names of the men. Okay, I said that. And Moses called Hoshea, the son of Nun, Joshua. That's sort of an English transliteration from the Hebrew. It's actually Yeshua is a better rendering of that, Yeshua. If you're reading a Greek Old Testament, it's Yeshua. And if you're reading an English translation directly from the Greek Old Testament, it would say Jesus there, okay? Because it's all the same name, just depending on which language you're dealing with. All right, verse 17. Then Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan and said to them, go up this way into the south and go up into the mountains and see what the land is like, whether the people who dwell in it are strong or weak, few or many, whether the land they dwell in is good or bad, whether the cities they inhabit are like camps or strongholds, whether the land is rich or poor, whether there is forest or not. Be of good courage and bring some of the fruit of the land. Now the time was the season of the first ripe grapes. This is, by the way, is fall. It's around the time of Rosh Hashanah. So they went up and spied out the land from the wilderness of Zin as far as Rehob, near the entrance of Hamath. And they went up through the south and came to Hebron. Okay, all those names. The descendants of Anak were there. Now Hebron was built 7 years before Zoan in Egypt. Then they came to the valley of Eshcol, and there cut down a branch with one cluster of grapes. They carried it between two of them on a pole. This was a big, enormous cluster of grapes. Pretty impressive stuff. They also brought some of the pomegranates and figs. The place was called the Valley of Eshcol because of the cluster which the men of Israel cut down there. And they returned from spying out the land after 40 days. Now, note that. 40 days they were in the land spying it out, these 12 men. Now they departed and came back to Moses and Aaron and all the congregation of the children of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. And they brought back word to them and all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. Then they told him and said, we went to the land where you sent us, and truly it flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. Nevertheless, the people who dwell in the land are strong. The cities are fortified with very large. Moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites dwell in the land in the south. The Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites dwell in the mountains, and the Canaanites dwell by the sea and along the banks of the Jordan. Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, let us go up at once and take possession, for we are well able to overcome it. But the men who had gone up with him said, we are not able to go up against this people, for they are stronger than we. And they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, the land though through which we have gone as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it are men of great stature. And we saw the giants, the descendants of Anak came from the giants, and we were like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were, as so we were in our own sight. Now, what are they challenging here? Did your hand go up?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was a father of a large group of men who were very large men. But I can't really give you any more history than that without going back and checking myself. Okay. But what were they questioning here?
God's power.
They're questioning his power. Were they questioning his faithfulness?
Sure.
Perhaps. Right? Perhaps. But he did say he was going to go in the land and defeat their enemies for them. Look what they said, though. They said, they are stronger than we are. Yeah. No kidding. But that's the point. They needed the power of God in order to defeat them, because if God didn't go in the land with them, they were going to be wiped out. They didn't believe him. They didn't believe him. That's the bottom line. They just didn't believe him. Look at the next verse, chapter 14, verse 1. So all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. And all the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, if only we had died in the land of Egypt. And God's listening to this. Or if only we had died in this wilderness. Why has the Lord brought us to this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and children should become victims? Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt? So they said to one another, let us select a leader and return to Egypt. You know, this is really idiotic. Okay, think about this. It took them 2 years to get from Egypt to this place. God defeated the Egyptians. God gave them manna every day and water out of the rock. Do they really think that if they overthrow Moses and select a new leader to take them back across the wilderness, that the manna is going to come and the water is going to come out of the rock while they are on their way back to Egypt? And when they get back to Egypt, do they really think Pharaoh is going to be rolling out the welcome mat? Can you see how stupid this is? Okay. Verse 5. Then Moses and Aaron fell on their faces before all the assembly of the congregation of the children of Israel. But Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes. And they spoke to all the congregation of the children of Israel, saying, "The land we pass through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord delights in us, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, nor fear the people of the land, for they are our bread. Their protection has departed from them. And the Lord is with us. Do not fear them." So what was the congregation's reaction? All the congregation said to stone them with stones. Wow. This is when God said, okay, that's it. I'm done with these people. Now the glory of the Lord appeared in the tabernacle of meeting before all the children of Israel. Then the Lord said to Moses, "How long will these people reject me?" And I want you to underline that, please, in your Bible. How long will these people reject me? How long will they not believe me? With all the signs which I have performed among them, I will strike them with pestilence and disinherit them. I will make of you a nation, that is Moses, greater and mightier than they. And Moses said to the Lord, "Then the Egyptians will hear it, for by your might you brought these people up from among them. And they will tell it to the inhabitants of this land. They have heard that you, Lord, are among these people, that you, Lord, are seen face to face, and you and your cloud stands above them. And you go before them in a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. Now if you kill these people as one man, then the nations which have heard of your fame will speak, saying, 'Because the Lord was not able to bring his people into the land which he swore to give them, therefore he killed them in the wilderness.' And now I pray, let the power of my Lord be great, just as you have spoken, saying, 'The Lord is long-suffering and abundant in mercy, forgiving iniquity and transgression, but he by no means clears the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation.'" Now, he's quoting, Moses is quoting to God part of the law that God gave to Moses to give to the people. He's quoting this from Exodus. "Pardon the iniquity of this people, I pray, according to the greatness of your mercy, just as you have forgiven this people from Egypt even until now. Then the Lord said, 'I have pardoned according to your word, but truly as I live, all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord. Because all these men who have seen my glory and the signs which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness and have put me to the test now these 10 times and have not heeded my voice, they certainly shall not see the land of which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who rejected me see it." Underline the words, "rejected me." "But my servant Caleb, because he has a different spirit in him and has followed me fully, I will bring into this land where he went, and his descendants shall inherit it. Now the Amalekites and the Canaanites dwell in the valley. Tomorrow turn and move out into the wilderness by the way of the Red Sea." And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "How long shall I bear with this evil congregation who complain against me? I have heard the complaints which the children of Israel make against me. Say to them, 'As I live, says the Lord, just as you have spoken in my hearing, so I will do to you. The carcasses of you who have complained against me shall fall in this wilderness, all of you who were numbered according to your entire number from 20 years old and above, except Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, the son of Nun. You shall by no means enter the land which I swore to make you dwell in. but your little ones, whom you said would be victims, I will bring in, and they shall know the land which you have despised. Now, what is God doing here? He said he's going to take everyone that was 20 years old and above who complained. Now, the text said earlier that the whole congregation of Israel complained against the Lord. Right? The whole congregation. But he said only those who were 20 years old and older, he is going to wait 40 years until they all die off, and then he's going to bring all their children in. Those who were 19 years and younger, he's going to bring them into the promised land 40 years later, or 38 years later. Okay? Why did he make a distinction there? I mean, the little children, if the parents were complaining against the Lord, no doubt the little children were too. But God made a distinction there in age, didn't he? Yeah?
Is that where the age of accountability people say?
Well, there is. I don't know that there's a specific age where people are accountable or not. I think that varies depending on the maturity of the child. But what God was showing there, in my opinion, was that he understands that these little children are not mature enough to understand, you know, or the younger ones were not mature enough to understand. The adults should have understood. They saw his signs. They saw his wonders. They should have understood what was going on. They should have trusted him. Stephen's laughing. What?
Yeah, no, just the term popped into my head. You can't teach an old dog new tricks. You know, and so that younger generation was going to be far more trainable and open to the lessons that would come over the next 4 years than the people who have already rejected
him. Exactly right.
Over and over again.
Yeah, he was done with them. He was done with them. Did they get a second chance? Well, let's see what happens. Go down to verse 32. But as for you, your carcasses shall fall in this wilderness, and your sons shall be shepherds in the wilderness 40 years, and bear the brunt of your infidelity until your carcasses are consumed in the wilderness. According to the number of the days in which you spied out the land, 40 days, for each day you shall bear your guilt 1 year, namely 40 years, and you shall know my rejection. Underline that, you shall know my rejection. Are they learning something? You shall know? Yeah, they're learning something. You're going to learn what my rejection feels like. And his rejection was total and permanent. Who is this lesson for? You shall know my rejection. Who is that lesson really for? Was it for the people that were going to die in the wilderness? Who is it really for? The children. As they watch their parents wander in the wilderness for 40 years while God brings them manna and water. But they have a death sentence. They're all on death row. That whole generation was on death row. And their children were watching and learning. And what we find happening is after those 40 years were done, God appoints Joshua to lead them into the promised land. And Joshua, because the angel of the Lord goes before him, they're able to wipe out the enemies of Israel and conquer the Canaanites through Joshua. All right? These are important lessons, but he's teaching the young people. The older people, he was done with them. They're just like furniture now. You know, push them off into the corner, put them out, you know, in the man cave. Have no use for them anymore. But God told Moses he wouldn't just kill them all at once, because then the nations would say, oh, look at this God, he killed all these people because he wasn't able to bring them into the promised land. Well, so God killed two birds with one stone there, so to speak. He judged his people, but he saved his reputation all at the same time. Pretty remarkable God we have. Well, let's look at what happens when those people whom God has written off now, suddenly they think that, oh, we got to do what God said now. We were rebellious and all that, but we're gonna do what God said. Okay, we're ready to do what God said finally. So what happens? Look at verse Let's start at verse 39. Then Moses told these words to all the children of Israel, and the people mourned greatly. And they rose early in the morning and went to the top of the mountain, saying, "Here we are." They're up in a mountain. They're looking out across the Jordan River at the Promised Land. They're looking across. You know, there it is, right in front of them. "Here we are, and we will go up to the place which the Lord has promised, for we have sinned." And Moses said, "Now why do you transgress the command of the Lord? For this will not succeed. Do not go up, lest you be defeated by your enemies, for the Lord is not among you." Underline that. "For the Amalekites and the Canaanites are there before you, and you shall fall by the sword because you have turned away from the Lord. The Lord will not be with you." But they presumed to go up to the mountaintop. Nevertheless, neither the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord nor Moses departed from the camp. And the Amalekites and the Canaanites who dwell in the mountains came down and attacked them and drove them back as far as Hormah. Wow. Unsuccessful. But see, that's the whole point. Unless God did it, it couldn't happen. There was no way this little band of Israelites who had been slaves in Egypt were going to go in to this fortified country and overthrow them and defeat them and possess the land that God had promised them unless God did it. He showed him he could do it. He showed him he was faithful. He showed him what his motives were over and over, saying, "I'm doing this because of the promises I made to Abraham." They didn't trust his motives. You know, they wanted to stone Moses and pick a new leader and go back to Egypt. They didn't trust him at all. And so what happens? He took them all out. Are they going to get another chance later, maybe sometime? No. That was their final exam. Did God break his covenant with Abraham? No. Because he didn't say, "I'm going to bring all of your descendants into the land." He simply said, "I'm going to bring your descendants into the land." So if he had done what he said originally to Moses, that is, bring Moses and make a great nation out of Moses, he still would have kept his word to Abraham. He didn't say who those descendants were going to be. If he had killed all these children of Israel at that time and just took their children in then, he would have kept his word. He wasn't going to violate his word. He had plenty of options that he could have done. But the point is, nowhere did he promise to bring all of them into the land. Nowhere did he promise to give all of them the promises that he gave to Abraham. He simply told Abraham, "These are the promises that are for you, Abraham, and for your descendants." But as we have seen in other lessons, it's not all of his descendants. It's some of his descendants. It's his descendants who walk in the footsteps of their father Abraham. The faithful ones like Caleb and Joshua here. They were faithful, right? Now, we have a few minutes left. I want you to flip over to Hebrews chapter 3. In this passage, the Apostle Paul keeps quoting from Psalm 95. Psalm 95 is a psalm that David wrote. It's a song about this whole episode that we just read about how Israel rebelled against God in the wilderness and how that he would not allow them to go into the land that he promised them, but later he took their children in. And in the psalm that David wrote, it talks about this historical situation, but also talks about a second opportunity that God is going to give them to go into the land and possess the land. And so when Paul is writing this a passage here, he's talking to us Christians, and he keeps quoting this psalm, telling us that when we get to this place, make sure we don't make the same mistake that the Israelites did. And what is he talking about? He's talking about the end times. Because remember, when God brought the children of Israel into Egypt the first time under Joshua, that was under a temporary provision that was provided by the law of Moses, which said, if you keep all these commandments, I'm going to let you stay in the land. But if you break my law, I'm going to drive you back out of the land. But the promise that he made to Abraham ultimately was that it would be a permanent possession, right? because of Abraham's obedience. And this is why the New Testament talks about us becoming Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise, because that land is going to be given again, a second time, as a permanent inheritance, just as God promised to Abraham. And we are on the very edge of that. We are getting very close to that, because there's another final exam for the people of God, those who call themselves Abraham's seed, as to whether they are going to pursue by faith the entrance into that promised land, which is the coming kingdom of Christ. All right, and this is how the Apostle Paul interprets this. So let's look at it real quick in Hebrews chapter 3, verse 5. And Moses indeed was faithful in all his house as a servant for a testimony of those things which would be spoken afterward. Oh, okay, so Moses was a faithful servant for a testimony of what was to come later. That's us. But Christ, as a son over his own house, whose house we are, if we hold fast to the confidence and the rejoicing of the hope firm to the end. Therefore, as the Holy Spirit says, and here he quotes this song that David wrote. Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion, in the day of trial in the wilderness, where your fathers tested me, tried me, and saw my works 40 years. Therefore I was angry with that generation and said, they always go astray in their hearts, and they have not known my ways. So I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter into my rest. That is, into that permanent possession of the land. That's what the rest is. But the first statement, today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. What Paul does is, from that statement, he infers that there's a second opportunity to enter into the land. Let's continue reading. Verse 12. Beware, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God. But exhort one another daily while it is called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. For we have become partakers of Christ, if we hold the beginning of our confidence steadfast to the end. While it is said, today if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion. For who, having heard, rebelled? Indeed, was it not all who came out of Egypt, led by Moses? That is, the whole congregation of Israel rebelled against God and against Moses. Now with whom was he angry 40 years? Was it not with those who sinned, whose corpses fell in the wilderness? And to whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest, but to those who did not obey? So we see that they could not enter in because of unbelief. Therefore, since a promise remains of entering his rest, let us fear lest any of you seem to have come short of it. For indeed, the gospel was preached to us as well as to them, but the word which they heard did not profit them, not being mixed with faith in those who heard it. For we who have believed do enter that rest, as he has said, quote, and he again quotes from the same psalm, so I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. Although the works were finished from the foundation of the world, for he has spoken in a certain place of the seventh day in this way, and God rested on the seventh day from all his works. And he's defining what that rest is, by the way. And he's going back to Genesis, talking about the 6 days of creation and how God rested on the seventh day. And again, in this place, they shall not enter my rest. What I want you to see is verse 4. He says that God spoke in a certain place about the seventh day. And then he quotes Genesis 1. And then he says, and again in this place. And then he quotes Psalm 95. What's Psalm 95 about? About entering into the rest, the kingdom. And he's saying it's the seventh day. Okay, we won't get into all that chronology stuff right now. Since therefore it remains that some must enter it, and to those whom it was first preached did not enter because of disobedience, again he designates a certain day, saying in David, today. In other words, again, because the children of Israel failed the first test, he is designating a second test of entering into the promised land of God's people. And he's calling it today. And he says, saying in David, today, after such a long time, that is, so long after the children of Israel rebelled against going into the land, David wrote this psalm about a second opportunity, all right? It has been said, today if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. He's talking to us. For if Joshua had given them rest, then he would not afterward have spoken about another day. That is another opportunity to go into the land and receive the possession of the land. There remains, therefore, a rest for the people of God. I'm going to stop there. But what kind of a lesson should we learn? I have it on the screen.
Be
afraid.
Yes. The children of the Israelites who came out of Egypt learned to fear the Lord because of the mistakes of their parents. And when they saw all their parents die off during that 40-year time, and they had to bury them out there in the wilderness without ever seeing the land that God promised to the children of Israel, those their children, when they grew up, here they are, they had to be at least, they were over 40 years old when they went into the land because, you know, they were out in the wilderness for that period of time. Joshua now, as an old man, leads these 40-plus-year-old men, army, into the land, across the Jordan. God parts the Jordan River just like he parted the Red Sea. They go through, and they go in, and they defeat the Canaanites and the Amalekites and so forth in the land, having learned from the mistakes of their parents. And then God took them into the land. But see, the exact same thing is happening to Christianity in the last days that happened to the children of Israel during that instance as well. And that is, they're going to be sorted. Those who trust God, those who trust his power, his faithfulness, his motives, and are committed to him no matter what, even going up against incredible odds, because that's what they were doing. When they were going into battle, they were going into battle way outnumbered. Not only that, you know, whenever you go in, if you're going to fight a war, in fact, one of the reasons why President Obama doesn't really want to get too involved in the Middle East right now and in, with all the stuff that's going on in Russia and all that, especially in Russia. Whenever you're going to fight somebody, you know, the Russians are invading the Ukraine and, you know, their neighbor. We're on the other side of the world. Do you know how much supplies and the logistics that it takes to move an army over there and then feed them and make sure they've got ammunition and make sure they've got all the stuff they have to defeat an enemy who is right next door to his own country and can just bring stuff in across the border? You know what it would take to defeat that from where we are? It's almost impossible. And we're probably the, you know, strongest nation on the face of the earth militarily. And it would be a real uphill battle. We probably couldn't do it. You know, that we'd get wore down by attrition. We probably couldn't do it. But here's the children of Israel with nothing but what they're carrying on their back. They don't even have food to cross over the desert. God has to provide it for them every single day and the water and all that. And now they're going to cross into enemy territory where the people outnumber them. They have walled cities. What kind of weapons do the children of Israel have? Do they have cannons? No. I mean, what are they going to do? You know, what are they going to throw manna at them? Seriously. You know, they got bows and arrows, and maybe a few spears and swords. But what is that against, you know, and what kind of logistics? What are they going to eat? You know, I mean, it's a totally impossible situation unless the God who showed them all those miracles steps up to the plate and keeps his word. Then it's a totally different ballgame. Because look what he did to Pharaoh, right? Well, you know what? Exactly the same thing is going to play out in the end times. Exactly the same thing. And if you are God's child, you're going to have to learn to pass those three tests right there. If you want to enter into the promised land, you're going to have to pass those tests. And you are going to be facing what appear to be incredible odds against you. And if you don't believe, and if you don't really, really believe the promises that are in this book, you're going to fail. when the rubber hits the road, you're going to fail. Okay? Yeah. All right, we'll end with that, unless there's any questions. No questions. People are shaking in fear. I said, be afraid, be very afraid, and we're all afraid now. You know what? You don't need to be afraid if you have faith. Was Joshua and Caleb, Joshua and Caleb afraid when they were telling all the people? Caleb said, no, let's go. God is with us. They weren't afraid. Some people look at them and say they were stupid. They weren't stupid. They knew who this God was. They learned some of these lessons. And we're supposed to learn the lessons. We got the record of it here. We're supposed to learn the same lessons. I hope we all pass those tests.